Hello and welcome to the Soccer History USA podcast. On today's episode, Stephen Apostoloff. Welcome to the podcast, Stephen.
Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure and an honor to be interviewed.
Well, why don't we start by, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got interested in U.S. soccer history?
Okay. I was the best striker in Sofia and Northern Paris. In my dreams, kidding. I have, in fact, two wooden legs. That's why I actually started researching soccer. A few words how I started. So I went to Boston College on exchange program. I was interested in immigration to the United States at that time. And I took a couple of sports history courses. I wanted to write about soccer because I didn't know much about other major American sports. People were laughing at me, including the professor. They said, it's not enough. It needs to be a 30-page paper. You can probably write a couple pages on U.S. soccer because history of that sport didn't exist. I was a little stubborn, continued to dig on, figure about the North American Soccer League, about ethnic soccer in the 60s, 50s, 30s, about the American Soccer League and the great books written by Colin Jost and later on Roger Alloway. And after I submitted a paper, which was a fine paper at the time, was encouraged by this professor to continue. It was a really big challenge to do this because the French didn't really accept it, the project. I was at first an American civilization major, American studies. I became an historian later on for my PhD studies. And I was fortunate to convince Jacques Pot, one of the most eminent French-Americanists, really embraced the project. Finding a research advisor, it's not everything. You need fundings. And I was really lucky to, I was awarded twice the João Avalanche scholarship from FIFA-based, from Zurich-based FIFA. And that's how everything started. And here I am after 9 years, nine years later on.
And your dissertation covered the history of soccer with a particular focus on Massachusetts. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely, this is correct. In my dissertation, I researched the popularity of soccer through the lens of immigration. I later on expanded the study to New England for the book manuscript that I'm currently completing. And the interesting thing is that I don't think that you can really write about American soccer because American soccer in New England was, one, it was a little different in New York, in Pennsylvania. It was totally different in the Midwest. And it's kind of young on the West Coast. So if somebody wants to write about the history of soccer in the United States, it's going to be a multiple volume work. So that's why I kind of decided to focus on New England, where the history of soccer is unique because it existed as an archaic game practiced by the Native Americans and the English colonists, as a pre-modern sport practiced by the Boston elite, and later on as association football, as the game is known to many Americans, in the many factories and textile mills in Massachusetts and around New England. And what is really interesting, even in a small state like Massachusetts, there are a lot of convergences between the East and the West, and I really embraced the piece of scholarship that you did about Holyoke. Oh, I think one of the reasons that it died there, as you put it down, it was really Anglo-Scottish. Whereas in Eastern Massachusetts, it very quickly diversified and other immigrants got involved. So this is one of the key divergences that you and I have in our scholarships.
Even though, as we were just saying, you're book and the dissertation in which it was based focus on the whole scope of history, but I thought today we might, given the fact that we're recording this in May of 2014 on the eve of the World Cup, I thought we might talk a little bit about the 1950 World Cup because you had the opportunity to interview several of the players who had been a part of that U.S. squad, The 1950 World Cup, of course, is probably most well known in this country because of the famous win over England. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about the men that you interviewed and maybe how those interviews came about.
Absolutely. This is a good question, excellent question. My case study covers more than 100 years of history, and on different periods, I depend on different sources. And for this particular period, the chapter of my dissertation and soon-to-be book is titled The Ghettoization of American Soccer. I had the privilege and the honor to interview five of the players of the U.S. National Team in 1950. And probably one of the most interesting of them and important for my study is John Souza. John Souza was born in Fall River, Massachusetts in 1920. His parents were immigrants from the Portuguese islands in the Atlantic, the Azores. And he said something very interesting. He started his interview with like a very, very interesting comment. He says, I was born in Fall River, and all we did was play soccer. We played the Irish, we played the French. I think by saying the French, he referred to French Canadians. He said, every section in Fall River had a soccer team, and they played against each other. And I would like to say how he learned to play and the teams that he played for. That John Souza played was Aruda Groceries. It was a Portuguese grocery store, and the owner actually had a soccer team. They also had a lot of social clubs. He later on played for the Portuguese Club of Providence. And that was actually one of the first teams that paid him money to play. He was playing, he was receiving $3 per match. A little bit later on, he started playing for the Ponte Delgada FC. And Ponte Delgada was actually a very interesting team. It was predominantly Portuguese team. Mm-hmm. And at some point, John Souza started playing for a team in New York. He was working for Firestone in Fall River. And when I say Firestone, they weren't doing tires. I think they were doing tanks. And some of them were used by the military. And at some point, he would just travel from Fall River to New York to play for a team called the German Hungarians. And his employers at Firestone weren't that happy because sometimes he would come back injured. He couldn't play on Monday. He couldn't, work on Monday. So that was interesting. And after a while, he had an offer to move to New York, which he did.
So you say that he was earning money, $3 a match early on, and then maybe a little bit more later, but yet he still had to have a factory job. So would you classify him as a fully professional player or maybe semi-pro?
He was not a fully professional. Let me just talk a little bit more on that, because when he moved to New York, to the Queens, and he was hired by the owner of the German Hungarians, who also had a textile factory. And it's interesting because he would sign every year a contract, $3,000. That was a lot of money back in the 50s, because this fellow wanted to make sure that he would play for him. And in Fall River, he was making at some point $15 per match. But for the German Hungarians, he would earn $50 per match. So you see, that's a big difference, 15 and 50. And he said that because of this money, he was able to retire at the age of 57, which was kind of early. You know, industrial workers would probably work much longer. So he was able to retire at this age and move to Florida. Mm-hmm. So he was a semi-professional, but very well-paid semi-professionals. We can talk probably about his teammates, Walter Barr, who was born in Kensington, just outside Philadelphia, and the other fellows from St. Louis. Walter Barr, who was a physical education teacher, was playing in the American Soccer League, the one that actually was semi-pro after the truly professional American Soccer League of the 20s.
Right, the ASL2, sometimes called.
Correct. And he said in his interview, which was very interesting, that during a very good season, he would match the money from semi-pro soccer with the money that he was earning as a physical education teacher. So he would make considerably less than John Souza, who would receive every at the beginning of each season $3,000, which was a big chunk of money at that point, not counting the money that he would receive after each game. And the other fellas from St. Louis, Harry Keough, Frank Borghi, Gino Pariani, some of them didn't make money, or they would make money. They would seldom make money. Harry Keough would say they were making. They would be given from Curtis Finier home. They would he played for a team of an Undertaker for a while. He said he would earn $5 for a win, $2 for a draw, and I think they would make a buck for a loss. He said, "Does it make me a professional?" And he laughed, obviously.
Now, many of these men also lost several of their prime playing years because of the Second World War. Did they talk about that experience at all in the interviews?
This is correct. I think the only person who didn't serve in the, and most of them served in the military, the only person who, I'm not sure if Harry Keough served in the military. I think he did, actually. Some of them were annoyed by the movie that was released, which was originally called Game of Their Life, and after that they changed the title to The Miracle Match because there were already movies with that title. I think they were annoyed by the fact that they shot them in the movie as party guys who were drinking and smoking, and they said we were born in the Depression. Nobody had any alcohol or smoked because they were serious athletes. John Souza served in the Navy, if I'm not wrong. Walter Barr didn't, for sure. And I was really profoundly touched by a story that Frank Borghi told me. He was involved in D-Day. He actually was on one of the beaches under a hail of bullets, and next to him there was a German soldier who was agonizing. He took off his coat and covered the body of the German soldier that was agonizing. So I think that was really novel, and I was profoundly touched by this story.
That's an incredible story.
Absolutely.
So how did the men then, after the war, they came back and presumably took up playing again, and how did they come to play for the national team?
This is a very interesting point. I think most of the people were from St. Louis because Walter Gisler was selecting the team, and obviously he wanted to make people from the Northeast as well. And John Souza was considered at that point as one of the finest players.
He had also represented the United States in various matches in Cuba and Mexico, I think, right?
Absolutely, and that was very interesting because at some point Ponte Delgado, they were playing in the Southern New England Soccer League. They won the Dewar's Cup, and they also won. They were dual champions. They also won the U.S. Challenge Cup. So that's why the United States Football Association just decided, instead of organizing tryouts and fielding a U.S. team, just decided to ask Ponte Delgado to represent the United States. And they went to Cuba. They played in '47, and John Souza actually gave me a very interesting picture. It's not a very good quality, but Ponte Delgado, actually, the entire team represented the United States for this tournament, qualifiers.
So the U.S. then qualifies for the 1950 World Cup, and they head down to Brazil. What did the guys say about their experiences actually in the tournament?
That's very interesting. I remember speaking to Harry Keough and also to John Souza about it, and they said we were scared. Actually, they were scared that, you know, they were facing the best team probably in the world, because England crushed many national teams in friendly games before that.
As you just described, it's probably no wonder they were frightened, as they were semi-professionals and maybe hadn't really had a lot of experience playing together.
Facing Stanley Matthews, Mortensen, some of the best professionals at some of the best English teams at the time. But I think, and ask him, obviously they were scared. All of them, they said that they played an exceptional game, and they were also lucky. The ball just, the English, they were pressuring, they were shooting from all angles. It was one of these days that the ball wouldn't go behind the American goal line in the American net.
And
they almost scored a second one, actually. It was Walter Bye described. He just kicked the ball. he said it was a little bit like a loose ball. He didn't really aim to do this. Joe Gittens kind of rushed and kind of just probably touched the ball and slightly changed the direction. And the English goalkeeper wasn't expecting this and ended up in his net. And as you pointed out, or Roger Alloy pointed out, there was a clip of this. There are a couple of clips, actually, German clips. And it's very interesting.
So in the few minutes we have left, why don't you tell us what you're currently working on, Stephen?
Absolutely. I'm completing my manuscript. Again, I expanded a little bit the scope. It has to do with New England. I don't have a very good case on Vermont or some parts of Maine, but a lot of leagues actually field the teams in Massachusetts and Rhode Island, in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut. So definitely there are multiple states involved in New England. And the last chapter that I'm currently working on, it's titled Beyond Beckham's Galaxy. It's got to do with the most recent challenges that Major League Soccer faces. And those challenges are the following. I think that the league really has lost the battle for respectful attendances and TV ratings. But on the other hand, video games such as FIFA Soccer could have a positive impact on the long term for the development of the league. And why? This is because of the live features, because this video game has changed so dramatically over the last decade. Right now, there are live features. And let's say if you pick up the New England Revolution, and MLS is one of the leagues in this video game, or I pick up the New York Red Bulls, and if you have injured players in the Red Bulls, and New England plays with full strength, this will be actually applied in our teams in FIFA Soccer. So in order to be competitive, one needs to either tune to a soccer match on TV or click on the website of MLS. In either case, this is revenue for the league.
Oh, okay.
And it also helps, the game helps young Americans to be educated, to learn about tactics, to learn about some foreign teams, if you wish. So it's a great educational tool.
Mm-hmm. And maybe key to the future of U.S. soccer.
Absolutely, absolutely, because FIFA Soccer is the most successful sports game globally. But in the United States, it sells about 50% of what Entertainment Art sells in terms of NFL Madden. But in real life, MLS, it's not 50% of the popularity and success of NFL. So right. This is a very interesting point. And FIFA Soccer is catching up very quickly with the basketball game. So those are very, very interesting observations, and nobody has ever written about video games and their impact on professional leagues.
Well, sports. I look forward to reading it.
Absolutely.
All right, thank you for joining me on the Soccer History USA podcast.
My pleasure, Brian. I really enjoy your podcast, and I'm looking forward to be listening to the podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Soccer History USA podcast. For episode notes, please visit the website at www.soccerhistoryusa.org and follow me on Twitter at @soccerhistoryus.